From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
Once again, Sunday night in Louisville, the religious right has tried to hijack religion, claiming their version of faith is the only one. When someone has stolen your faith, it's time to take it back. When did Jesus become pro-rich, pro-war, and only pro-American? I think it's time for a rescue operation here.
God's politics, why the right gets it wrong and the left doesn't get it. We speak with preacher activist Jim Wallace as Senate Majority Leader Bill Friss fights the filibuster on judicial nominees by participating in Justice Sunday, stopping the filibuster against people of faith. Then President Bush meets with Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah at his ranch in Texas.
High oil price will damage markets, and he knows that. I look forward to talking to him about that, but as well as, we'll talk about his country's capacity.
And today is the third anniversary of the arrest of Palestinian human rights activist Farouk Abdelmouti.
I win in this moment the freedom, but still our struggle continues, because this war is war for rights, for justice, the rights of the detainees, immigrants, and the right of all the people fighting for justice and equality.
Farouk Abdelmouti was jailed for 2 years without charge. He died last summer at the age of 57. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A U.S. military investigation has cleared the soldiers who shot dead a high-ranking Italian intelligence agent last month in Iraq. The intelligence agent, Nicola Calipari, died on March 4th after U.S. troops opened fire on the car that was also carrying Giuliana Sgrena, the Italian journalist who'd just been freed from captivity. Sgrena and the Italian government have disputed the U.S. claims that the shooting was justified. In a front-page editorial in her newspaper, El Manifesto, Sgrena wrote today, quote, "After the apologies comes the slap in the face." Sgrena criticized the U.S. investigators for failing to take into account her testimony as to what happened. The Italian government has refused to endorse the U.S. Army's findings. Italy maintains the car carrying Calipari and Sgrena had been driving slowly, received no warning, and that Italy had advised U.S. authorities of their mission to evacuate Sgrena from Iraq. In other news on Iraq, it's official. No weapons of mass destruction have been found in Iraq. On Monday, the Iraq Survey Group published its final report on the hunt for WMDs. The group concluded that a 2-year search had uncovered no nuclear, biological, or chemical weapons stockpiles in Iraq. In addition, the U.S. investigators reported they'd found no evidence that any weapons of mass destruction were moved to Syria before the war. The Independent of London is reporting the U.S. has forced out a top human rights investigator at the United Nations just days after he released a report criticizing the U.S. for committing human rights abuses in Afghanistan. The Egyptian-born law professor, Sharif Bassiouni, had spent a year in Afghanistan interviewing Afghans, international agency staff, and the Afghan Human Rights Commission. His official title was Independent Expert on Human Rights in Afghanistan. In his new report, Bassiouni accused U.S. troops of breaking into homes, arbitrarily arresting residents, and torturing detainees. He estimated around 1,000 Afghans had been detained. Bassiouni also indicated the U.S.-led forces had committed sexual abuse, torture, and use of force resulting in death. He wrote, quote, "When these forces directly engage in practices that violate international human rights and international humanitarian law, they undermine the national project of establishing a legal basis for use of force." Just days after he released his report, the UN eliminated his job under pressure from the United States. In other news from Afghanistan, the BBC is reporting a 29-year-old woman has been stoned to death for committing adultery. It marks the first such stoning since President Hamid Karzai took office. The woman, whose name was Amina, was stoned to death by her husband while her lover received 100 lashes and was released. The city of New York has admitted that a total of 465 HIV-positive foster children took part in experimental AIDS drugs trials between 1988 and 2001. At the time of the tests, all the foster children were under the legal guidance of the city's child welfare department. The city has been accused of using the children as human guinea pigs to test highly toxic drug cocktails. On Friday, Mayor Michael Bloomberg announced an outside nonprofit organization had been hired to investigate whether the drugs were administered properly. Two city council members, Bill Perkins and Charles Barron, have called for an independent probe. Most of the foster children involved in the experiments were poor and black, ranging in age from infants to teenagers. Last year, a BBC documentary revealed some of the children were forced to take part in the experimental drug trials against their will. In Washington, more criticism is being leveled against John Bolton, President Bush's pick to be ambassador to the United Nations. The latest criticism centers on warnings issued by Bolton in 2002 and 3 about Syria's effort to acquire unconventional weapons. Former intelligence agents are now saying Bolton's warnings exaggerated the intelligence on Syria. One unnamed Syrian senior official told the New York Times Bolton routinely sought to push his assertions beyond the views endorsed by intelligence agencies. A new study by Save the Children has found that almost half the 300,000 children fighting in wars today are girls, some of whom are as young as 8 years old. The report entitled Forgotten Casualties of War said the girls are often abducted, raped, and used as currency among fighters. Girls have been found fighting in a number of countries, including Colombia, Pakistan, Uganda, Philippines, Sri Lanka, Liberia, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Mike Aronson of Save the Children said, quote, "When people picture conflict, they think of men in bloody combat. But it's girls who are the horrifying and hidden face of war." In business news, United Airlines has reached a settlement with the federal government that'll result in the airline saving $645 million in each of the next 5 years at the expense of taxpayers. The government is allowing the airline to hand over four underfunded pension plans in what the Wall Street Journal is calling the largest corporate pension default in U.S. history. As a result of the settlement, employees of United will receive smaller pensions than they were once promised. The Association of Flight Attendants described the settlement as, quote, morally criminal. Several of United's unions have threatened to strike if their pensions end. The Center for American Progress noted Monday the Federal Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation agreed to allow the airline to shed $10 billion in pension commitments, just as President Bush signed legislation making it harder for citizens to declare bankruptcy. In Texas, the State House approved a measure Monday to amend the state constitution to ban same-sex marriage. The state Senate must now approve the amendment. Meanwhile, Connecticut has become the second state in the country to offer civil unions to same-sex couples. Connecticut also became the first state to do so voluntarily. Vermont is the other state to allow civil unions. Massachusetts allows gay couples to marry, but those changes came about after same-sex couples won court battles. Over the weekend, the state capitol in Hartford saw a series of protests around the issue. Gay rights activists criticized civil unions as second-class citizenship. Meanwhile, conservative groups vowed to fight the re-election of any legislator that supported civil unions. In Long Island, a 39-year-old man has died after police shot him repeatedly with a taser stun gun. The incident occurred Friday night after friends of John Cox called police because he was acting erratically. Cox reportedly had not taken his antipsychotic medication. When police arrived, Cox became agitated and police shot him several times. Witnesses said police beat and kicked the man as well. Medical examiners have found Cox had cocaine and alcohol in his blood at the time of the shooting. In San Francisco, a federal court jury is expected to begin deliberating as early as today in a trial involving a series of activists who were repeatedly pepper sprayed during nonviolent protests by police in Humboldt County in 1997. Video recorded at the time showed police swabbing the eyes of protesters with Q-tips dipped in pepper spray. Police continued to do so even after protesters screamed out in pain. The incidents occurred during anti-logging protests in the lobby of the offices of Pacific Lumber Company and in the office of then-Republican Congressmember Frank Riggs. for the Trees by Matmos here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The battle over President Bush's judicial nominees reached the new heights this past weekend. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist delivered a taped speech in which he again threatened to ban Democrats from filibustering Bush's court nominees. While the Republican leader's rhetoric was the same, it was the venue of his address that grabbed national headlines. The speech was part of an event organized by Christian conservative groups called Justice Sunday, Stopping the Filibuster Against People of Faith. It was held at a packed Baptist church east of Louisville, Kentucky, and was simultaneously broadcast to churches around the country, as well as to 61 million households. In his speech, Dr. Frist threatened again to change Senate rules to use what is known as the nuclear option, changing Senate rules to ban filibusters of judicial nominees. Democrats have said they would retaliate by bringing most Senate business to a halt. But now the Senate's top two Democrats, Minority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada and Minority Whip Richard Durbin of Illinois, say for the first time they would consider a compromise in which some of the seven stalled nominees would be confirmed and the others withdrawn. While Senator Frist didn't mention religion in his speech, others who were headlining the event did. Charles Colson, head of Prison Fellowship Ministries, said filibustering of court nominees is, quote, destroying the balance of power, which was a vital Christian contribution to the founding of our nation. Religious groups and Democrats said Frist should have played no role in the heavily promoted broadcast, which they say inappropriately brought religion into a political debate. New York Senator Charles Schumer said the move, quote, clearly argues people of one viewpoint have God on their side and all others are faithless. Meanwhile, according to a new Washington Post ABC News poll, Americans are opposed to changing the Senate rules by a 2-to-1 margin. The group MoveOn.org says they'll finance TV commercials criticizing the rule change, and organizers will hold 120 rallies around the country on Wednesday, including one in Washington, with a speech by former Vice President Al Gore. We're joined in our Firehouse studio by Jim Wallace. He's author of God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. He's founder of Sojourners Community and editor of Sojourners Magazine. Welcome to Democracy
Now!
Thanks,
Amy. Great to be here.
It's good to have you with us. So let's talk about this event that took place on Sunday called Justice Sunday and Senator Frist's participation, the Senate Majority Leader.
It was pretty amazing. You know, I've looked through my Bible, and I can't find filibuster anywhere. I really looked hard, but it's not there. A bit of historical perspective. After he was arrested once, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. wrote a very famous letter from a Birmingham jail to white clergy who opposed him. And it was about racial segregation and violence against black people. Never once did he say they weren't people of faith. He challenged their faith. He wanted them to go deeper with their faith, but he never said, my opponents are not people of faith. That's what they're saying. Now, if King wouldn't say his opponents weren't people of faith over racial segregation violence, how can the right do this over a filibuster? There's something crossing a lot of boundaries here.
Well, what really is the big deal? It's their opinion versus yours.
Well, I think it's fine for people to bring their moral conviction, their religious conviction in the public life. King did that. I do that. The religious right does that. But when you say those who oppose us, who have a different view, are not people of faith, or Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson said during the campaign, you can only vote for George W. Bush. Now they're saying you must also agree with all his judicial nominees. Now, this is really the hijacking of religion. It's making it into a partisan wedge and a weapon to divide us, not a bridge to bring us together. This is really the abuse and misuse of religion. We're having these town meetings across the country disguised as book signings, and what I'm learning is people are tired of the monologue of the religious right. And the good news, having been in the East and in the Midwest and the South and even Texas and the West, is the monologue of the religious right is now over and a new dialogue has finally begun.
And yet, isn't it at the height of their power?
Well, it's interesting because they're in the White House now. So you could say, yes, it's at the height of their power. But more than ever before, it's almost like the rise of the non-religious right, which isn't much of a name for a movement, but that's what I'm sensing and feeling all over the country. So a lot of people are saying, wait a minute, the way faith is portrayed in the election, in the media, and invoked in the White House isn't my faith. I've got faith, too. I've got moral values, too. They don't speak for me. So a lot of other people are saying, I want my voice to be heard as well.
This event that took place, Justice Sunday, filibustering people of faith, took place in Louisville, Kentucky. You were there that day.
Well, there was another service, a counter service. 1,200 people showed up on about a week's notice. So, and that's what I'm finding all over the country, packed churches to say, well, their faith isn't our faith. And the monologue doesn't represent the dialogue we now need to have. So it was lots of energy in the room, good preaching, good choirs, and people said, wait a minute, I don't agree, and they can't say. This one guy from Kentucky, he said, I've been an evangelical Christian my whole life. Imagine my surprise when I woke up and found the newspaper saying, I'm not a person of faith. Imagine my surprise. It was a great event to say, wait a minute, because someone doesn't agree with a judicial nominee or a Senate procedure, you know, filibusters have been used for good and for ill. But my goodness, this isn't a theological matter here. And so they're really overstepping, they're overreaching. Last night we had a debate I was on with Dobson and Moeller.
Explain who Dobson and Moeller are.
Well, James Dobson, the head of the Focus on the Family, one of the organizers of this event, and Albert Moeller, the president of the Southern Baptist Seminary, also one of the planners of this event. And they're already beginning to back off, which they should. We never said this is not about people of faith. Well, they said this was a filibuster against people of faith. They said the Democratic Party is hostile to people of faith. That would be news to Barack Obama, for example, who's a deeply Christian person, member of a black church in Southside Chicago. So this kind of rhetoric is really getting very old for a lot of people. I've often said when people steal your faith in the public arena, it's time now to take it back.
I want to read you the beginning of a piece that was in the New York Times a couple months ago, mm-hmm. New York Times Magazine, Faith, Certainty, and the Presidency of George W. Bush by Ron Suskind. And it says, Bruce Bartlett, a domestic policy advisor to Ronald Reagan and a Treasury official for the first President Bush, told me recently, if Bush wins, there'll be a civil war in the Republican Party starting November 3rd. The nature of that conflict, as Bartlett sees it, essentially the same as the one raging across much of the world, a battle between modernists and fundamentalists, pragmatists and true believers, reason and religion. Just in the past few months, Bartlett said, I think a light has gone off for people who've spent time up close to Bush, that this instinct he's always talking about is this sort of weird messianic idea of what he thinks God has told him to do. Bartlett's a 53-year-old columnist and self-described libertarian Republican who's lately been a champion for traditional Republicans concerned about Bush's governance, went on to say, this is why George W. Bush is so clear-eyed about al-Qaeda and the Islamic fundamentalist enemy. He believes you have to kill them all. They can't be persuaded that they're extremists driven by a dark vision. He understands them because he's just like them. Goes on to say, this is why he dispenses with people who confront him with inconvenient facts. Bartlett went on to say, he truly believes he's on a mission from God. Absolute faith like that overwhelms a need for analysis. The whole thing about faith is to believe things for which there is no empirical evidence. Bartlett paused, then said, but you can't run the world on faith. Can you talk about that?
You know, religion is being used by some to provide us with what we really long for, which is a kind of easy certainty. But the better use of religion is to provide us a deeper reflection. For example, if we can't see the face of evil on September 11th, I suppose we're suffering from some kind of postmodern relativism or something. But to say they're evil and we are good is bad theology. Jesus said, don't just see the log in your adversary's eye, but also the one in your own eye. So that kind of bad theology, they're evil and we're good, leads to bad foreign policy, to preemptive, unilateral, and endless war. Fundamentalism exists in all of our religious traditions. And the antidote to it, I think, is prophetic faith. The answer to bad religion, I think, is not secularism, but better religion. So how do we talk about a prophetic faith? In my Christian tradition, I want to talk about Jesus. How did Jesus become pro-rich, pro-war, and only pro-American? It doesn't make sense. And yet that's what we're faced with. So really, a rescue operation is what I think is required now, to take back our faith from those who've made it into a kind of a political weapon and a wedge. The religious right is the political seduction of religion. The religious right was the idea of the political right. They created it. There were meetings, Republican political operatives, TV preachers. A deal was made. Give me your lists. I'll make you famous. It was a Faustian bargain. But what happens is when the progressives concede the entire territory of religion and values and faith to the right, then they get to define it however they want to. And they have, in this very narrow, partisan, ideological way. So that's what I want to take back here.
We're talking to Reverend Jim Wallace, and we'll be back with him. He's author of Why the Right, he's author of God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. Back in a minute.
We've laid the cables and the wires. We've split the wood and stoked the fires. We've lit out town so there is no place for crime to hide. Our little church is painted white, and in the safety of the night, we all go quiet as a mouse, for the word is out that God is in the house. God is in the house. God is in the house, no cause for worry now. God is in the house. Moral sneaks in the White House, computer geeks in the schoolhouse, drug freaks in the crack house. We don't have that stuff here.
God is in the House by Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 330 radio and TV stations around the country on Pacifica stations and NPR radio, as well as on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we video and audio stream at democracynow.org, where you can also sign up for our daily email headlines as well as media alerts. And we are closed captioned for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest in the studio is Reverend Jim Wallace. He's an evangelical preacher, founder of Sojourners Magazine more than 30 years ago, and has a new best-selling book out. It is called God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It, A New Vision for Faith and Politics in America. I bring up best-selling, Reverend Wallace, because, I mean, you've been doing this for over three decades. And what is it? Suddenly this has caught on? I mean, at a time when people are saying that the right is in control, the religious right is at its height, your vision of religion, secular religion, has caught on?
You know, it's almost because of their success, a lot of people are saying, wait a minute, I'm a person of faith too, and they don't speak for me. I was on Meet the Press with Jerry Falwell, and he said one of his usual crazy, outlandish things, and I just looked at him, and I said, Jerry, when you say those things, millions and millions of American Christians want to say to you, say to the nation, you don't speak for me. And I almost felt like a million saying, yes, yes, yes. And all across the country, we just packed houses every night because people, it isn't about a book. It's about a desire to have their faith heard too, their voice heard too. And, you know, religion doesn't have a monopoly on morality. Never has, never will. But we've had in our history progressive, prophetic movements of faith that have fueled every major social reform movement, abolition of slavery, child labor law reform, women's suffrage, of course, civil rights. To take back that prophetic faith when we need it right now is something people are very excited about.
How do you see the invasion and occupation of Iraq?
When I was on John Stewart, he said, "You want to apply the teachings of Jesus to politics?" And I said, "Yeah," and I don't think his first two priorities would have been a capital gains tax cut and the occupation of Iraq. You know, the truth is, and the media never told the story, that every major religious body around the world was opposed to the war in Iraq except our American Southern Baptists. The Pope was. The Pope is hardly a liberal religious leader, but he shook his finger at George W. Bush in the Vatican. The White House didn't get the photo op they wanted that day. This Pope was against the war in Iraq.
Yet this hardly got that kind of attention from the media.
No, it didn't at all. And I was stunned because I've never seen such a unity among religious leaders around the world. In fact, every evangelical group around the world, even in our allied countries like the UK, they were all against the war in Iraq. And yet that never got reported here. Tony Blair met with a number of us before the war, the run-up.
You met with Tony Blair?
With Tony Blair, five American church leaders. The president, President Bush, would never meet with any of us who had questions about the war in Iraq. There was a powerful, the majority of Christians around the world were opposed to the war in Iraq because by any criteria, this was not a just war.
And so what do you think needs to happen right now, and what about the situation for Muslims in this country?
Well, you know, there will never be a resolution in Iraq until the American occupation is over. The American occupation is not the solution. It's the problem. You know, there's a, Reza Aslan, who's got a great new book out called No God But God. He's a young Islamic scholar. He was on Jon Stewart just this past week or so. He says there's a big battle internally going on within Islam. It's not the clash of civilizations like Samuel Huntington says, the West and Islam. It's within Islam, fighting for the heart and soul. So I feel that way about my Christian faith. We're fighting for the heart and soul of our traditions against a fundamentalist sort of takeover that really wants to take over all of them, and then a prophetic faith which is the counter to it. And so in every religious tradition, there's a prophetic, progressive tradition stream, energy, movement flowing. And I'm finding young people all over the country who want to join that. They want to sign up. They want to be part of them. They want to. Faith does big things. It's supposed to change the things that no one else thinks can be changed, the things that have no hope and the odds are against us. That's why we have faith. 3 billion people living on less than $2 a day. That's a big thing. 30,000 people, children dying every day in a silent tsunami because of lack of clean drinking water and lack of food. That's a big thing. These are the big things faith is supposed to change. Instead, we're debating filibusters.
We're talking to Reverend Jim Wallace. He has written God's Politics, a new book, but he has been the editor of Sojourners Magazine for many decades. Can you talk about the founding of Sojourners Magazine, why you did it in early 1970s, and the difference between the climate then and the climate today?
I was fresh out of the movement. I'd been kicked out of my little evangelical church at 14 over the issue of race. And I joined the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement. And I came back, really, to Jesus. I found in Jesus the most radical historical figure I'd ever known. And I was captivated, converted by this radical Jesus who turned the world upside down. So I went to seminary, and I found a different kind of religion there than I had found in the Gospels. We started this thing, and we said, you know, we want to be as radical, try to be, as Jesus was. And so we started this. And at first it was aimed at movement folks like us, and it attracted all these Christians who were tired of a private faith, either just me and the Lord, not the world, or a very kind of reactionary right-wing faith. And so we began this movement a long time ago. It's been like speaking in a stadium without a microphone. You can reach a section at a time. We've been going around the country, and we have a serious constituency. But now the time has come that the microphones are now open to a different kind of voice. So now the right doesn't have the monologue anymore. And it drives them crazy. There's a dialogue now, and they don't know what to do with that. So we're going to have a serious debate with the religious right about what faith means, and with the progressive side, you know, the right gets it wrong because they want to narrow all the moral values issues. There's just two: abortion, gay marriage. That's it. You know, what about 3,000 verses in the Bible on poverty? Fighting poverty is a moral values issue. Protecting the environment, otherwise known as God's creation, that's a moral values issue too. And as you say, the ethics of war. When you go to war, how you go to war, and whether you tell the truth about going to war, these are profoundly religious matters. The left, I think, needs to recover its own progressive history, its heart and soul, its moral vocabulary, and not give the right this whole territory of religion, values, and politics. We can't ever do that again. That was a mistake.
Reverend Wallace, we've just been joined on the telephone by a U.S. Navy sailor. His name is Pablo Paredes. He refused to get on the ship to go to Iraq in California, and he has just been denied conscientious objector status and will be court-martialed on May 11th. Pablo Paredes, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, amen. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about what just happened? We're also in the studio with Reverend Wallace.
Well, it's the conscientious objector package has been denied at the local level, which means it's a recommendation for denial, but usually that pretty much trumps everything. And beyond that, they've gone ahead with the idea of the court-martial, and they're pretty much just going to ignore the conscientious objector package. They can take sometimes even up to 2 years to get approved. So what they've done is they've accepted the denial at the first stage and kind of taken it as reason to say, well, we don't even have to pay attention to it anymore. We'll just move right along with the court martial.
Now, this is despite recommendations from the Navy chaplain, the Navy staff psychiatrist, as well as your colleagues and theirs?
Right. Despite very strong recommendations from their own colleagues, the Navy chaplain went as far as to say that it was morally imperative. People that work strictly with conscientious objection packages have said it's the strongest recommendation they've ever seen. And beyond that, even the investigating officer who recommended denial of it went as far as to say that she felt everything I said was sincere and convicted in the hearing, and based most of her problems with my package on a handful of statements made to media, which obviously showed one side of what she wanted to get across.
Why are you saying no, that you won't go? And can you describe what you did on December 6th?
Sure. On December 6th, a culmination of a lot of thought and a different point of view for about 2.5 years in Japan kind of occurred, and I decided to refuse to board the Bonhomme Richard. The Bonhomme Richard is an LHD. What they do is they ferry Marines to wherever they're needed. In this case, they would have gone to the Gulf, and the Marines would have made their way to Iraq. What happened is I got to the point where even that kind of involvement in this war and in any war just became something that I couldn't do anymore. I couldn't, enlist in. So I refused to board the ship, and I wanted to do it very publicly so that hopefully mainstream media would have an excuse to cover some anti-war, some dissent, some voices of resistance.
Why are you so opposed to going, and what did you think you would be doing when you signed up to be a U.S. Navy sailor?
Well, about 4.5 years ago when I did sign up, I had a very different outlook on life and a different kind of maturity in my morality. And the Navy and the Army and all the branches accepted that can happen to a person. I mean, it's pretty clear that who you are at 18 and who you are beyond that are two very different ball games. So at 23, I'm somebody that can fight in a war. And at 18, I was somebody that didn't think about those things. And that's probably the major aspect as to why, you know, my perspective is different today. And, you know, I can't justify war. I've become somebody who looks at things in a very broad scope in a very human way. And you know, in that context, I don't think anybody could ever accept war as a means for anything.
Reverend Wallace, as you listen to Pablo Paredes, you're traveling around the country. What about this reaction, this level of resistance in the military? Pablo is certainly not alone.
No, Pablo, thank you. Thank you, Pablo. I'm talking to Iraqi veterans a lot. They're coming back. Some went to the war believing they were there to defend their families against a nuclear 9/11 or whatever. And now they're coming back and saying, this wasn't true. This was all based upon a lie. And we've all been changed forever. Many have been killed, many more wounded, and we've all been changed forever, they say. There's a conversation we need to have with our warriors are sent to fight and then forgotten. They come home and no one cares. No one cares. I think congregations really ought to surround people like Pablo. I mean, he's 23 and he's making this kind of stand. Our congregations ought to welcome our warriors home. And let them say what they saw. Let them have their voice, because this war simply was not just a mistake. It was a mistake. It was a diversion. It was a distraction. But it was wrong. It was morally wrong, theologically wrong, religiously wrong. And I admire young people like Pablo who didn't just say it was wrong, but put themselves at risk to act on what Jesus said. Blessed are the peacemakers, not the peace lovers. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Well, Pablo, I think, fits that description pretty well.
Pablo, you're going to be court-martialed on May 11th, yet there are major plans for May 10th. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, the last part of that, there are major what?
There are major plans for May 10th around the country, recognizing what is going to happen the day after the court martial. Can you talk about these plans of protest?
Oh, sure. Well, everyone that's been kind of supportive of what I've done along the way, most of the activist community locally and people that I've gotten a chance to reach out to, and my brother's gotten a chance to reach out to in New York and even beyond, are really, really, really wanting to show their support at this moment, and they're really also wanting to obviously take advantage of the situation and a chance to air some dissent and to rally around it. So locally in San Diego on May 10th, there's going to be some event. We're going to rally, try to kind of consolidate the voice of dissent, which and give it a megaphone. So what's going to happen is Camilo Mejia, who's already served a year in prison for his dissent and for his opposition to this war, basically for his humanity, is going to be here to speak out. Aiden Delgado, who is also an ex-military member who submitted a conscientious objective package and was approved, and now speaks out on what he saw and the atrocities that led him to become a conscientious objector. And obviously I'm going to tell my side of the story. And so it's a very, you know, very human argument that I think, you know, crosses partisanship and crosses politics. So I really hope that we get a voice. And beyond that, a lot of people are very into the idea of doing some protests. I'm not just here, but people want to come down from other places. And, you know, that's what America was built on. So,
well, I want to thank you for joining us. Do you have a website where people can get the latest information on your case?
Yes, my brother has made a website. It's called www.swiftsmartveterans.com.
Swiftsmartveterans.com.
That's right.
And Reverend Wallace, are religious leaders, you're saying congregations should rally around those who've come back from Iraq, also people like Pablo Paredes, who's refusing to go, are religious leaders talking about standing up for these conscientious objectors, whether they're recognized by the military? I mean, people like Camilo Mejia, who served close to a year in prison, the Florida Army National Guardsman who went to Iraq, came back, then refused to return after leave.
Sojourners organized 1,000 vigils on the second anniversary of the invasion of Iraq all over the country. Very powerful vigils. We're going to do that again now around Memorial Day, and this time the focus will be on the veterans. Iraq War veterans coming home have really been abandoned, have really been just cut loose. And so I think congregations have to really surround them. And then out of that, let them tell their story, number one. Two, talk about how this the occupation, American occupation and control in Iraq will never lead to a serious transfer of sovereignty to the Iraqi people. And thirdly, we've got to talk about what led to this war in Iraq, this policy, this neoconservative foreign policy, this demonstration of raw American power, that our security is premised on absolute U.S. military supremacy. This is in direct contrast to the prophets. I say in the book, Micah has a very different vision than Donald Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld says security comes only by military supremacy. Micah says there is no security except for common security. We won't beat our swords into plowshares, our spears into pruning hooks, until everyone has their own vine and their own fig tree, which means you got to drain the swamps of injustice in which these mosquitoes of terrorism breed, or you'll never defeat terrorism. Micah and Rumsfeld present very different visions. So we have to offer not just a protest, but a very different vision of how we find security in this kind of world.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Reverend Wallace. I know tonight you will be with Cornel West at
My
Princeton
buddy Cornel
University.
West, prophetic religion as a counter to nationalistic religion, fundamentalist religion, and theocracy. Republican theocracy is not the answer to our problems, as we saw in Louisville last night. But prophetic religion, talking about justice and peace and the kind of welcoming, inclusive moral discourse on politics. That's an inclusive view of faith. That's what I think is the future.
Reverend Wallace is author of God's Politics, A New Vision for Faith and Politics in America. Also want to thank Pablo Paredes for joining us. Just found out that despite positive recommendations from the Navy chaplain and a staff psychiatrist, that he has been denied conscientious objector status, at least at the local level. Now it makes its way up. He will be court-martialed on May 11th. Thank you both for being with us. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll talk about President Bush's meeting yesterday in Crawford with the Saudi prince. Stay with us. Preview 73 here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Look forward to seeing folks in Montclair, New Jersey on Wednesday night. And then we're going to head this weekend to Arizona, to Scottsdale, and to Tucson. This is Democracy Now! President Bush met with Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah on Monday at his ranch in Crawford, Texas. The two leaders discussed soaring global oil prices, as well as political reform in Saudi Arabia, the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, and the so-called war on terror. But it was the price of oil that topped the agenda. Crude oil prices hit record highs in April, briefly topping $58 a barrel. Nationwide retail gas prices have climbed to over $2.28 a gallon. Prior to Abdullah's arrival, Bush spoke to reporters at his ranch about oil and the energy bill.
So of course, I'll talk about energy, and Crown Prince understands that very important for there to be a make sure that the price is reasonable. High oil price will damage markets, and he knows that. I look forward to talking to him about that, but as well as, you know, we'll talk about his country's capacity. It's an important subject. One thing is for certain, I need to sign an energy bill. And I appreciate the House passing the energy bill. And now it's time for the Senate to pass the energy bill. The bill's a long time in coming. The Vice President and I suggested they pass the, a bill in 2001. And nothing happened. Now's the time for something to happen. Looking forward to get back to Washington and continue to talk about energy.
Sir, do you think gas prices can be any lower than it is today?
That depends on the supply and demand. You know, one thing is for certain, the price of crude is driving the price of gasoline. The price of crude is up because not only is our economy growing, but economies such as India and China's economies are growing.
President Bush speaking to reporters at his ranch in Crawford on Monday, standing next to Vice President Dick Cheney. Crown Prince Abdullah arrived soon after with a small entourage. Bush greeted him with a hug and a kiss on both cheeks. The president then took Abdullah's hand and his and guided him up the path leading to his office, taking care to point to a field of blue bonnets on the way. The meeting between the two leaders was the first in 3 years. Abdullah arrived in the United States on Sunday, where he met with Vice President Dick Cheney. The Saudis presented a plan to increase oil production over the next decade and what the Wall Street Journal describes as a, quote, recap of plans the Saudis already had announced. Meanwhile, in a letter to President Bush, Human Rights Watch called for charges against three Saudi dissidents to be dropped. The three were imprisoned for more than a year for petitioning a constitutional monarchy. In the letter, the group also said Bush should urge Saudi authorities to appoint women to the recently formed municipal councils and to establish a moratorium on the use of the death penalty. Joining us online from California is Assad Abu Khalil. He is a professor of political science at California State University Stanislaus, a visiting professor at UC Berkeley. He's the author of several books. His latest is The Battle for Saudi Arabia, Royalty, Fundamentalism, and Global Power. He runs a blog called the Angry Arab News Service at angryarab.blogspot.com. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor.
Good morning, Amy.
Welcome. Talk about the significance of yesterday's meeting.
I mean, I thought yesterday that even the image was beyond the significance of the two walking, holding hands. I mean, this sends a message throughout the Middle East, and it speaks far louder than the hefty, exorbitant expenditure on propaganda since September 11. I mean, it seems the obsession with crude oil prices overwhelmed any other talk about the Arab-Israeli question, about the so-called spread of freedom in the Middle East, and more importantly, even the so-called war on terrorism and the House of Saud production of fanatical Muslims throughout the world. It was very obvious that all the vapid speeches that Bush has been making about democracy and reform in the Middle East all are pushed aside in order for those two to get together and for the president to emphasize about what he called one time the permanent friendship between the two governments. Here is somebody, the president of the United States, who made himself totally bogusly a symbol of somebody championing reform and democracy in the Middle East, holding hands literally in this case with the head of a religious dictatorship, one of the worst violators of human rights throughout the world. And I'm sure the agenda, which talked about how the Saudis can invest some $50 billion more in order to produce, satisfy Americans' demands for oil, and all that dwarfed or in fact excluded concerns about the recent, very recent human rights violation inside the kingdom. Only days ago, 40 Pakistani Christians were arrested because they dared to hold a religious ceremony in one of their houses. There is a Saudi professor who was arrested and sentenced to 4 years in jail because he dared to give an interview to Al Jazeera TV. Just yesterday, all the Arabic media, but not the American media, reported about some senior member of the Saudi counterterrorism unit was arrested by the government because he dared to criticize it on Al Jazeera TV, and on and on and on. I mean, Arabs always knew all along that this is no serious championing of human rights and democracy, that Bush's idea of freedom clashes, in fact, with real freedom in the Middle East, that this was all propaganda intended to fool the American public. And I think, unfortunately, it has worked.
We're talking to Professor Assad Abu Khalil, who's a professor at California State University. Agence France-Presse is reporting that a member of the Saudi delegation was denied entry into the United States after authorities found he was a government watch list. Did you hear about this, a member of Prince Abdullah's delegation?
Yes, I posted it on my website yesterday. I saw that, and I felt it was incredible how it didn't get any prominent mention in any U.S. newspapers. In fact, I did look in U.S. newspapers, didn't find it mentioned whatsoever. It seems there was an attempt to cover it up. Perhaps this was too embarrassing. Here was the man who was greeted in Bush's personal farm, and he intended to bring with him somebody who was on American terrorism watch list. I mean, that says something, of course.
What about the Human Rights Watch organization call for these dissidents to be released from jail, saying that President Bush should demand this, naming these men who signed a petition for a what were they calling for? I believe their names Matruk Fali Ali Al Domeini and Abdullah Al Hamid.
Well, I mean, just as scores of other Saudis have been jailed over the years, they dare to question the ability of the royal family to hold severe monopoly over the reins of power. They wanted to establish some formal constitutional arrangement so that people will have some powers. And let us not be fooled about the recent attempt to fool the world, and of course it didn't fool any Saudi, with the so-called municipal elections in the country. And even with those, you know, the fundamentalist seems to be winning with the participation and support of the royal family itself. These were so-called municipal elections where some of the 50% of the population who are males were allowed to vote in elections for 50% of the seats of really powerless municipal councils throughout the kingdom. This is like the so-called consultation council, which the king appoints but absolutely adheres to none of its decisions, and they have no power whatsoever. These are just formalistic changes that they make in order to fool the outside world. I don't think the Europeans are fooled. The human rights organizations are not fooled. But I guess the American public, which doesn't keep a close tab about what's going on around the world, whenever they hear about Bush that he is helping in the spread of freedom, many of them, I think, at least judging by the result of the last election, apparently they are convinced. But in the Arab world, nobody has any doubts about this. They know. I mean, the meeting yesterday couldn't have taken place if this president is serious in the least about supporting human rights in the region. If anything, regarding human rights organization, I just wish that Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, are far more vocal about the abysmal record of human rights inside that kingdom.
And President Bush has not commented on the recent election in Saudi Arabia that was dominated by Islamist groups. Women were not allowed to participate. Your comment?
Well, I mean, there is absolutely no power that is attached to these councils. And, of course, 50% of the population are not allowed, and 50% of the seats are appointed by the royal family itself. So, I mean, the royal family just want to make sure, just in case, that there are some dissident voices that may infiltrate through, although they are doing all their best to prevent that from happening. I mean, this is not serious reform that nobody can be take with any respect. This is the record of the royal family for the last more than 60 years. That's what they do. Whenever they're pressured, they make some cosmetic changes that are absolutely meaningless, and this is only one of them. I mean, the president, in fact, in the joint communique, showered some praises on the royal family for the so-called recent events and elections and so on.
Finally, Professor Abu Khalil, if you could briefly comment on the final Syrian pullout from Lebanon.
Well, I'm so glad you asked me about that, because I was really unhappy about the giddy and the very silly way that the president and his cronies reacted to events in Lebanon. Just last week, Zogby International conducted a comprehensive survey of the Lebanese people, and it turned out there is one country in Lebanon that is more unpopular than Syria, and that is the United States. And we also have to say that it seems there are good and bad demonstrations as far as the United States is concerned. When Bush was praising some demonstrators against Syria, apparently, according to the Lebanese press, the U.S. government has officially pressured the Lebanese government because for the last week, and this is something the Washington Post and New York Times have not covered once, thousands of Lebanese students have been flocking to the U.S. embassy to protest the interference by the United States in Lebanese affairs. And the U.S. embassy apparently is very unhappy about that. And these are peaceful demonstrations, I should say. And now they want them to stop, so the Lebanese government is now pressured to do so. I think that the withdrawal of Syria, perhaps, is going to allow the Lebanese to, again, manifest their very deep divisions and conflicts. And this time, they will not have Syria to blame. They will only have to face them themselves. But this is Lebanon. It's never going to be independent. Syrian domination is now being replaced by a collection of outside dominators led by the United States, Saudi Arabia, and France.
Professor Asad Abu Khalil, we want to thank you very much for being with us. As we wrap up today, on this third anniversary of the arrest and imprisonment of Palestinian human rights activist Farouk Abdelmouti, jailed for 2 years without charge. He died last summer at the age of 57, just 3 months after being released. In March 2002, Farouk began working at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. He worked with us to arrange interviews with Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza on our morning show, Wake Up Call. Farouk was detained a month later, April 26, 2002, jailed in various facilities around the country for 2 years, never charged with a crime, often held in solitary confinement, subjected to extensive interrogation, often denied food. His health was failing, but he remained handcuffed and shackled whenever he went to the health clinic. 2 years after his detention, a federal judge ordered Farouk be deported, charged, or released. He walked out of prison April 12, 2004. On July 21, 2004, after giving a speech in Philadelphia, his head fell to the table. He collapsed and died shortly afterwards. His last words were, quote, "I believe nobody can stop the Palestinian struggle, and I believe it's not going to stop our insistence for rights." To commemorate the third anniversary of Farouk's arrest, we bring you an excerpt of Farouk speaking the day after he returned. He joined us at Cooper Union before 1,000 people. This is Farouk Abdelmouti in New York City on April 13th, 2004.
From the deep of my heart, I thanks to all of you because I am a small atom of your society and your communities. And I thanks to the WBI and Radio Pacifica and Democracy Now to support me and to continue this struggle to I win in this moment the freedom. But still our struggle continues because this war is war for rights, for justice, the rights of the detainees, immigrants, and the right of all the people fighting for justice and equality and against racism and oppression. And we continue this struggle until we win.
Farouk Abdelmouti speaking last April. He was arrested 3 years ago today. He died this past summer. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkudus, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. Tonight's event in St. Louis is rescheduled to May 13th. On Wednesday, we'll be in Montclair, New Jersey, and then in New York on Thursday, and then we go to Arizona, Tucson, and Flagstaff, and Scottsdale. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.